Welcome to the News Hour, the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest this morning is Lawrence Velville. He's Dean of Massachusetts School of Law. He's also a professor of law there. Earlier, he taught law at the University of Kansas, Catholic University. He's been a partner in major Washington, D.C. law firms. He has done a very great deal. He's also editor of the MS Law Journal. He contributes occasionally to Global Research. Larry, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi, Steve. Thank you very much.
Can you hear me clearly? You're coming in a little bit faintly.
Well, I'll try and speak up a little,
I can hear you better now.
Got on an airplane flight a week ago, it would be good if you spoke up also.
Oh, well, I'm trying my best. Can you hear me all right?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Maybe my producer can turn up the volume just a little bit, and hopefully the people listening in can hear this just fine. But there's a lot going on, Larry. I'm very, really delighted to have you on the program, and there's so much to talk about. You recommended a few topics. Let's jump into one. You mentioned at the top of the list that you sent me war crimes, and I hope by war crimes you mean, since it's making headlines daily, what's going on now in Gaza. It's truly horrific. I've written four articles on it. I have a fifth one done, just about done, for tomorrow or Thursday. I already have a sixth topic in mind, and I go into great detail talking about it, and I pull no punches. This is very ugly stuff.
Well, I did not mean Gaza. And you would find out that I largely disagree with what I think you're...
What's going on in Gaza now?
So there's not much point in discussing that.
I'd be happy to hear your point of view and present mine.
Well, I don't... Well, my point of view is very brief. But rather than present my point of view about what's happened for the last... Well, one can say the last 2,000 years. One can say the last 75 years.
Well, I would
one
say
can
after
say
the
1967. 19... One can
I
say
would say Balfour 1917 was a line in the sand.
Well, I prefer not to discuss any of that because I belong to a people, as do you, I gather, who have been victimized. I'd rather talk about what I think should be done now, and I think it's very simple. I think answers are often very simple. The reason things are tricked up is because people do not want to accept uncomplicated answers, and so they trick things up. There's something I suggested 2 years ago in one of my postings. I suggested in connection with the battle, the war against Hamas in southern Lebanon. Naturally, not being somebody who's a celebrity, nobody even responded to what I said, let alone thought about it. But it's quite simple, and it's this. I think that in Gaza and on the West Bank and perhaps as well in southern Lebanon, there ought to be independent Palestinian states. I'll exclude southern Lebanon from that, but something else is relevant.
Larry, can I interrupt you?
Palestinian states.
Let me interrupt you. When we hear that music, it means a commercial break. Let's take it and then you pick right up as soon as we come back. Larry, I want to let you pick up one quick comment. I believe you're Jewish, and so am I, and I strongly feel that the issue is not a religious one. It's a political one, and, well, there's so much more, but you pick up on what you were saying.
All right. As I was saying, I think there should be independent Palestinian states, but they should be completely demilitarized. No tanks, no rockets, no artillery. No machine guns of the old, of what we used to consider machine guns, although, of course, automatic rifles are machine guns in effect. No bombers, no fighter planes, no nothing but a police force. That this deal should be guaranteed by England, France, Spain, Italy, and the United States, maybe even Egypt. They should have a responsibility to see to it that the deal is followed. They should be required to put in troops if the deal is not being followed. And Israel, and no, it would be a violation of the deal if the army of any foreign state, Iraq, Iran, or whomever, crossed into the Palestinian states. And Israel would have a right, if such a thing happened, to go into the Palestinian states themselves to fight the enemy. I see that as the only way to get over the whole problem. Otherwise, we will never get over the problem, because what is fundamentally at issue here is Israel's great fear that it is going to be wiped out someday by attack, constant attacks, or one big attack from these areas in Gaza, in the east, on the West Bank, and from southern Lebanon. And I know I've never heard anything else but independent but demilitarized Palestinian states. I've never heard any other suggestion which has a ghost of a chance, at least not since Arafat turned down the Barak's offer.
Well, I'm losing you, Larry. I'm losing you.
I said I've seen, other than what I'm suggesting.
Here we go.
Yeah, I said, other than what I'm suggesting, I have not seen any other deal which even conceivably could work, at least not since Arafat turned down Barak's offer within a Camp David with Clinton. Yeah, it was, as a matter of fact.
Well, Larry, it's a good thing we're not talking about this, because I certainly disagree on what Arafat turned down. It would be lovely if there was total demilitarization of the Middle East and all parties agreed, and Israel agreed, and there was teeth in it. The problem is that nothing is ever even discussed with teeth. It's always a one-way deal, because Israel is the world's fourth most powerful military, a country with a population about the size of greater Chicago.
Oh, you can't.
It's a nuclear power.
A nation of 7 million people, more powerful than Russia, China, France, England, Spain. Be a break, Steve.
Oh, they have the most modern weapons and technology, and of course the Palestinians have no tanks, no F-16s, no Apache helicopters. They have homemade rockets, Larry. They make them in garages and basements.
The point is to create peace, and a demilitarized area is the only way I've ever heard it. And if Israel has stronger armies than the Palestinians do, that hasn't created peace. In fact, we had much stronger armies than anybody in Iraq, and it's been one lesson that's been learned first in Vietnam, and then everybody forgot it. But now it's relearned in Iraq, and it's been relearned in the Middle East, is powerful armies do not make the difference necessarily, or maybe even ever, when you're dealing with guerrilla warfare and insurgent warfare. So, you know, to tell me how powerful Israel is makes absolutely no difference. Israel's got atomic bombs. What are you going to do, drop it out of an atomic bomb on the Gaza Strip?
Well, I certainly hope not.
Well, that's just silly. So it's silly to compare the power, and it's even silly to discuss, frankly, whether this is a religious in origin, political in origin, or what it is in origin. I mean, you can make a pretty good case that Europe, going back centuries, is responsible in a direct line for what's going on now. But that's all irrelevant. The point now is to figure out some way to make peace, and I know of no suggestion other than demilitarized independent nations for doing that.
It's a tough thing to solve, and I think we both would agree on an awful lot of things if we disagree on this. We believe in the rule of law. We believe in equal justice. We believe that there's a history of persecuted people all over the world. I have an obsession about Haiti, and I don't know of any people that have been more oppressed longer by a mile than the people of Haiti. 500 years just here. We can go back into history of the Middle East. I get a little foggy when we get back in past centuries, and the people who write all this stuff, there's a lot more myth involved in it than there is fact. But it's really both sides. I mean, you've got people, you've got human beings. This is the issue for me, Larry. We've got human beings, and I honestly believe in humanity and human rights and all those old-fashioned things that, that people with the most power tend to forget about. And I think no country more grievously than the one you and I live in and are citizens of. When you mention war crimes as a topic, were you referring to Afghanistan and Iraq?
Well, I was referring to torture.
Ah, well,
some
that's
of which
indeed
has
a very big
in
issue.
Afghanistan and, some of which has occurred in Afghanistan and Iraq.
I've written a good deal about it. I've written about the torture, and you won't like this, two separate articles. Torture is official U.S. policy. You may go with that, but the other one you'll take great exception to, and we won't talk about it. But I quoted official stuff. Torture is official Israeli policy. Well, that's a separate topic, and we won't get into it. But just the one I wrote on the U.S., Larry, I was astonished that I found reams of official memos, documents, basically sanctioning torture as official policy in the Bush administration. The John Yoo memo being just one.
Well,
the famous torture memo, the infamous torture memo.
I certainly agree with all of that, and in fact, I am the chairman of a steering committee which is seeking prosecution of high-level Bush officials, who, both executive in the executive sense and lawyers in the executive branch, who are responsible for all of this. And, in fact, we put out a memo, I'm surprised you haven't gotten it, about a few days ago, last Friday, actually, called the Preliminary Report of the Robert H. Jackson Committee on Possible Prosecutions. And this report details, unlike a lot of other books and reports which discuss all kinds of things that are related to this, this report just goes down the line, says what happened, where did it happen, and who was responsible for it happening, who participated in making the policy, who carried out the policy, and who warned the administration time and again, not just judge advocate generals, they did, but also people on the ground who were FBI agents, people on the ground who were naval criminal investigative service agents, and so on and so forth. I think this memo probably is the major piece of work right now in terms of simply listing the facts of what happened. So I agree with everything that you've said. And, of course, John, you and others, let us not forget Stephen Bradbury in 2005, they wrote these absurd legal memoranda, which, by the way, ignored the leading case in the field. And they did exactly like a mafia lawyer might do. They did exactly what their bosses told them to do. So, yes, I think there's been fantastic torture. And I certainly agree that this is not the country that I grew up in or that you grew up in.
No, it's not. It wasn't the perfect place ever. I think we both know that. But it's gotten repeatedly worse through the years. And the Bush administration, I wrote a very long year and article, Larry, assessing the Bush legacy. And you take it bookend to bookend, going back to the very beginning, to the way it ends. It is the most outrageous record imaginable for any leader of any nation, U.S. or any other place. And I documented a chapter and verse, a very, very long article, one of the longest articles, maybe the longest article I ever wrote, because how do you cover 8 years in a short article? As far as Afghanistan and Iraq are concerned, I think the issue goes back on the subject of war crimes. The issue begins with attacking two countries based on no threat of those countries to us, and that's the initial war crime. We committed the war crime, Justice Robert Jackson, you mentioned, the war crime of illegal aggression, I forget its precise words, war against peace, but illegal aggression, the supreme international crime that Jackson talked about. We committed these in Afghanistan and in Iraq. But we've done it a lot of other times, too. We did it against North Korea. We did it against Vietnam. I've written about all this stuff, Larry. I just wrote an article that they got back into North Korea, Vietnam, et cetera, and so forth. I mean, pretty awful stuff, dropping the two atomic bombs on Japan while they were trying to surrender. Totally defeated country, trying to surrender. And they refused, we refused to accept their terms because they only wanted one thing, to keep their emperor, which we let them do anyway. But we had to drop those bombs to send the Russians a message that we were the toughest guys around. And, of course, they got their own bombs, so they were the second toughest guys around. And then they had that horrid Cold War. I mean, this is pretty awful stuff, but it's really bad now. Oh, my goodness, we have another break coming up. Oh, I don't mean to get carried away, Larry, because I want to give you the time to talk, and we have other things that you want to talk about as well. Let's take a break, and we'll pick it up exactly where you want to.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Dean Lawrence Velville. Larry, we have another break on the half hour, then a much longer segment, but let me let you pick it up where you left off. Or maybe
well,
where I
left
off.
I left off listening to you, Steve.
I apologize. I don't like to monopolize the conversation. I want you to do it.
Well, what would you like me to talk about?
Well, we're talking about war crimes, torture, whatever.
Well, I think you were talking about the fact that the United States has a long record of aggression against other nations. Actually, that's one of the great problems and the mindset that it has created and in turn led to is one of the great problems. This country has often, usually, gone to war, not in World War II, I would judge, but almost all, and maybe not in Korea, but most other times has usually gone to war for a mix of motives, some good. We were always told by McKinley, for example, that our motives are all to the good. But in point of fact, the motives were mixed, and the economic benefit, commercial benefit, was always a part of the picture. That was true, I guess, from the time of King Philip's War, although I'm not too sure about that particular war. Right up through all the wars of the 19th century and through wars of the 20th century, it was true in Iraq. We tend to think, and Andrew Bacevich is very good on this. I just interviewed him for an hour and a half for television about his recent book on the subject. We are a nation which has always sought war and which thinks that war is the way to solve problems. That's unfortunate. Stephen Kinzer, whom I interviewed for 2 hours for a television program, wrote a book talking about what we'd done from Hawaii in 1893 right up until Iraq. And he talked, among other things, for example, about our creating the assassination and the coup d'etat against Mossadegh, which has led to the problems in Iran for the last 50 years. He talked about why we got involved with the Philippines and Cuba for commercial purposes at the time of the Spanish-American War, about the invasions in Nicaragua and other South American countries. So we have this major problem in the United States, a problem of mindset where we think we're always doing things for good purposes, never for commercial or evil purposes. People tend to think war is the answer to everything, and that we have a right to go around the world to impose our view. Well, this is all just a disaster, and if we don't stop it pretty quick, our country is going to fall apart, I would judge, within the next 50 years.
I agree with you absolutely, Larry. It's an agenda of insanity. It cannot go on, and right now, With all categories thrown in that we even know about, and there's a lot that we don't know about, we're spending annually in excess of $1 trillion for defense, military, call it anything you want, was all of this money we're throwing at the economic crisis. I mean, if nothing else, we're going to bankrupt the country. We really are bankrupt right now.
Well, I think there's a strong potential for that, for the reasons that you suggest.
It's a shame to see a country that should be a world leader, and instead we literally sow over and over again seeds for people around the world to absolutely despise us. And I don't know how you dig out from under the 8 years of George Bush, where we really are. I mean, we're really looked at about as evil as some of the most evil regimes anywhere. We just run around the world pillaging any place that we want to go, doing anything we want to do. It's pretty outrageous. I mean, I'm ashamed to call myself an American with this kind of stuff going on. And it's the reason I accidentally started writing a few years ago. And here I am hosting a radio program. It's because I simply can't take it anymore. And I don't want to sit back and do nothing. And I want to be a voice against this kind of stuff. I want something better. You want something better. And we agree. If we don't get it, heaven only knows what's coming down the road. It won't be good.
No, I think that's true. And it is certainly no less true because we are faced with the prospect of the worst recession, call it depression, if you wish, since 1929-30. And whether Obama, in whom I have great hopes, is capable of solving these problems, I think, unfortunately, remains to be seen. He makes a lot of good noises, but people say for political purposes, and the question is it for political purposes or is it a matter of belief? He also makes a lot of noises in the opposite direction. He appoints people who think whom one thinks are pretty good, and then simultaneously he's also appointing people who represent the ancient regime, so to speak, and who made mistake after mistake in the 1990s when Clinton was in power, and I would include Clinton's wife, I would include Larry Summers, I would include the influence, if any, upon this administration of Robert Rubin, who is not part of this administration, at least not yet, and other people who collaborated with George Bush in the disaster, like Geithner or Geithner or however you pronounce the guy's name, who's going to be Treasury Secretary. So, you know, whether Obama will prove to be the individual who is capable of turning this around remains to be seen. And if he's not, then one has to wonder, because clearly he is the brightest guy who's been.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Hour. I'm on with Larry Belville. I know we have more topics to go over, Larry, and you want to talk about Bernie Madoff. Maybe let's finish up on Obama, and then we can jump over to talk about Bernie Madoff. And I also wrote about him. I'm an equal opportunity targeter, and I have written tons about the Obama administration during the campaign, his appointees. I have gone over every single one of his high-level appointees, except for Leon Panetta, because I didn't know about him. And I mentioned Admiral Blair is the most likely guy to be the National Intelligence Director. And I exposed what an outrageous pick he is. But you go right down the line, Larry, and they're the kind of people that James Petras, who comes on this program often, he calls them the dregs of the Clinton years. These are the same people that got us into the mess we're in now, and Obama is hauling them all out again to make things even worse than they are now. You know, you can't judge a guy until he gets in there and starts doing stuff, but the evidence already is so strong that leads me to conclude this guy will do nothing to solve our problems. He will only make them worse. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, you could be right, Steve. You could be right. I think there, as I said, that there are other people who are not remainder men from the Clinton administration, but to have appointed the people who are from the Clinton administration seems to me a bow in the direction of conventional politics, a bow in the direction of people in the Democratic Party who wish to maintain their control over that party, and is just more of the same when this country really has to change dramatically in its culture, in its, which is, I think, the crucial thing. I think culture is always the crucial thing, and its views, and its current disregard for honesty, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, without any question. There are so many issues that we've gotten wrong and need to turn around and get right. For me, the absolute top two are getting on this economic crisis and addressing it properly, and the other one is ending illegal wars and stopping our supporting of illegal wars by other countries, all other countries. I'm not just talking about Israel. I'm talking about any other country. It's illegal. We have an Arms Export Control Act that says you cannot sell weapons to any country that will use them other than for defensive purposes. But we sell them to countries who only use them for offensive purposes and never for defensive purposes. Well, you know, it goes on and on. But, of course, this economic calamity alone, this is real, real big, serious stuff. And I'm not an economist, so just exactly whether it will turn out to be a Great Depression. A week ago Monday, I had a very, very astute economist on the program, Bill Engdahl, and he says that there's a very strong possibility that we will not have another Great Depression. What we may very well end up having is a first-time-ever very Great Depression. That's pretty scary stuff, and he makes a heck of a case. He can make the case I can't because he's an economist and he knows his stuff. But again, who can predict? But all this other stuff coming on, and I hope I'm wrong, and Obama turns out to be a lot better than I fear. But he sure will surprise me, Larry, if it turns out that way.
All right. Well, one thing that I think people must do in this life, and Americans utterly refuse to do, is to learn from history. Now, that's a very peculiar thing because every human being learns from his or her own history. If something has worked out very badly for you time and time again in the past, you're bound not to do it again. If you have techniques and policies that have worked out very well for you personally in the past, you're liable to continue them. But on the national level, we do not care a whit about history, and we don't follow it. And therein lies disaster. As in the 1880s, you know, if you don't know history, you are condemned to repeat it. Among the people who are in the new Obama administration are the people who created the current disaster in ways that individuals normally don't even think about. For example, Robert Rubin, who's not in the administration, but who's the godfather of so many who are, and Larry Summers and others were all in favor, as were people in Congress, of doing away with the Glass-Steagall Act, which was the Post-Depression Act of 1933, which separated out commercial banking from investment banking, because by engaging in all kinds of investment banking, buying and selling stocks, trading stocks, and so forth, commercial banks got into horrendous difficulties. They lost their money. They went broke, and the whole banking system collapsed. So Glass-Steagall was tasked to say, well, you can't do that anymore. You must be either an investment bank or a commercial bank. You cannot be both. Well, starting in the 1980s, the controller of the currency Federal Reserve Board began to allow banks to create structures, holding companies, really, so that a bank through a holding company could become not only a bank but could become an investment company and vice versa. And now what we've seen is that this has and people like me who knew about Glass-Steagall and, you know, even wrote about it at the time, hell, we weren't even straws in the wind. We weren't, you know, we were, it could hardly be said that we were even whistling against the wind. Nobody was listening. And what we've now seen is that due to the fact that a commercial bank and an investment bank can be combined in a single bank, as with, for example, Citigroup, and due to the extraordinarily powerful lobbying efforts of Sandy Weill combined with the views of people like Rubin and Summers, this has caused the collapse of the banking system once again, just like it caused the combination of investment and commercial banks being a single bank has caused the collapse of the economy once again and a depression once again, just like in 1929. So the people who caused this are back, and they're in the administration. And, you know, one can only wonder about how successful an administration is going to be when it employs people who have shown such horrible judgment, not to mention lack of knowledge of history in the past.
Oh, amen. Amen. I agree with that 100%. And I'm also very concerned. Yesterday I had a guest on, an economist, Jack Ramses, and he and I agree that we think the monetary policy that's gone on has been atrocious. There's a possibility that the fiscal policy could turn out to be very good, but he believes there's an even greater possibility that it will not. It hasn't happened yet, hasn't passed Congress, so we don't know. But my suspicion from everything that I can just kind of read between the lines and glean is that just like every time in the past, this will end up being a plan primarily to help business and do far less than what's needed to help individuals. And I can't imagine how a plan like that can work. We've got millions of people in jeopardy of losing their homes. They're losing their jobs. Jack yesterday said that the last couple of jobs reports of 500,000 plus jobs lost, this is pure fiction. He says it's more like a million jobs lost per month. I believe it. I think it's a lot closer to a million than 500,000 because they absolutely corrupt the formula on how to calculate it to make things look better than they really are. So we're literally leeching hundreds of thousands of jobs. People are scared to death. Even the one people who have their jobs, they're scared to death they're going to lose them. And people have exhausted their ability to spend, so there's no spending. People have all of these fears that they live with daily. If we don't help households, individuals, working people, how on earth can we ever fix the economy? My feeling as a non-economist is I think it's impossible. And if that happens, then we could be in for years of some terrible, terrible stuff.
Well, I don't think you have to look any further than the fact that Congress appropriated these hundreds of millions of dollars for bailout, and it was supposed to be given to the people who were losing their homes because they had been induced. Sometimes it was their own fault, but mainly it was not. They had been induced to buy these absurd adjustable rate mortgages, and adjustable rate mortgages were always from the beginning and observably a disaster waiting to happen. None of those people did not get the money, generally speaking. The banks kept it. The banks didn't loan out monies. The banks, and for good reasons, by the way, according to bank loan standards. But the point is they didn't loan out the money. They bought other banks instead. They continued to make bonus payments to the executives who had driven them into the ground. So the little man who's losing his home got no benefit from a bill that was supposed to be a benefit to him. And Congress did nothing. And Obama, to make Paulson do what he should do instead of what he actually did. And now Obama is apparently, from what I read today, is asking through Bush that more money be released into the banks again, when the money really should be going, all of it, quite frankly, to the people who were induced to these horrendous adjustable rate mortgages that are the cause of the entire problem. Because once they became securitized and sold on the market as securities, well, it was Katie bar the door. And by the way, I'm sure you're aware that the Wall Streeters who were selling all this stuff, they didn't understand it because it was not understandable. So people in the know, people who knew anything, knew that they were selling stuff that was incomprehensible. I think that Warren Buffett called these kinds of derivatives, he had a phrase for it.
Financial weapons of mass destruction, Larry.
That's right. There's a nuclear weapon waiting to happen or something like that. I first read about it years ago in Barron. This was no secret to people that individuals and people on Wall Street did not know what was going on and could not tell you what these derivatives were all about. Well, when you operate on that kind of intellectual dishonesty, that kind of incompetence, you're just asking for trouble. And Obama has not, to the best of my knowledge, reversed this as of yet.
Absolutely not. I would say that's the granddaddy of all Ponzi schemes. But you want to talk about another one, too, and that's Bernie Madoff. And I wrote about him. I wrote an article late December that I call Early Suspicions About Bernie Madoff. I had an awful lot of stuff in that article. I quoted a 2001 Barron's article that raised suspicions about him. But the real clincher was a guy named Harry Markopoulos. In November 2005, Markopoulos sent a 21-page, extremely detailed document to the SEC, and he raised 29 red flags. That was a slam-dunk case that Bernie Madoff was a huckster. He was a fraudster. He was running a Ponzi scheme, and I quoted extensively from Markopoulos in my article, and the SEC absolutely didn't touch it. Well, the SEC doesn't go after the big guys. They go after the little guys. I don't know how many of those, but they don't go after the Madoffs and the Wall Street types. And Mary Shapiro, who Obama appointed to be the next SEC chief, she's another fox to guard the hen house. In plain English, Larry, she won't do a damn thing to go after the same people who'll come up with new scams down the road, because that's her job, to ignore all of them and just go after some little people and make us think that she's doing her job. She's a consummate insider and one of the worst people who ever could have been appointed to that job, but that's Obama's choice. Your comments about Bernie Madoff.
Well, in point of fact, Markopoulos's memo to the SEC did not start in 2005. That was only the most updated version of memoranda that he had first given to the SEC sometime in 1999 or 2000.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. That's right.
And throughout the 2000s, he continuously prodded the SEC, and he got nowhere. Now, the SEC back in 1992 had investigated the entire Madoff scheme, which at the time was being, in a sense, run. Well, now let me put this more accurately. There were two accountants in Florida, Venus and Avellino, who raised about $400 million for Madoff from 1962 to 1992. The SEC investigated them on the theory that they were operating, that they were selling securities, which they were, de facto securities, and made them stop. And at the same time, it looked at Madoff and announced that while it had made Venus and Avellino stop selling unregistered securities, there was nothing the matter with Madoff. He was not at fault. There were no indications of fraud by Madoff. Well, no indications of fraud by Madoff. Never in the next 60 years, despite Markopoulos, despite an article in 2001 by a guy named Michael Oakland, despite the article you're talking about in Barron's by Elizabeth Arvidlund, and despite the fact that Markopoulos kept coming to it and updated his memo, the SEC did absolutely nothing. And Mary Shapiro's outfit, she was at the time the president or chief executive or whatever one calls it, of the NASD, which had private investigatory functions, and therefore, according to what I heard in according to what I read in the congressional transcript for January 1st, NASD inspected Madoff every 2 years. It found nothing. And when FINRA was created by merging the NASD with the New York Stock Exchange regulatory arm in 2007, FINRA examined Madoff again, and it found absolutely nothing. Obviously, the SEC and the FINRA weren't trying very hard. There's a lot of problems. There were a lot of red flags, a lot of problems. It is a shocking fact that despite the red flags raised by all of this, including all the red flags raised by Markopoulos, the SEC never subpoenaed information or documents for Madoff. They would simply talk to Madoff, and he would give them some BS, and he would give them whatever documents he chose to, which I guess we can figure were probably made up out of whole cloth. And on those bases, it found that, it did not find that Madoff was doing anything wrong. And to use a current word, clawed back its statement in 1992 that, there was no indication of fraud. By 1999 and 2000, 2001, there were plenty of indications of fraud.
We have to warn
people.
We'll be right back. Back to the News Hour. I'm on with Larry Belville. Larry, we have just a few minutes left, and I'll let you finish up with Madoff. I absolutely mentioned in my article that in May 1999, Markopoulos alerted the SEC's Boston office. He followed up with the New York office. The New York office finally did a minimal investigation. They found some irregularities and whitewashed the whole thing and dropped it. Just walked away from it.
Well, that's right. And I personally think that unlike other bailouts, unlike the losses which have led to other bailouts, those losses which were caused by terrible decisions by the companies and their executives and not by crime, which the government had a duty to stop, the Madoff situation was caused by the failure of the SEC to perform what has been its duty since 1933, which is to make sure that there is not fraud, let alone massive fraud, in the United States. I think this is one of the unusual cases where people who sue the SEC, in other words, who sue the government, are likely to recover. The smart money lawyers, the people who give you reflexive advice, would tell you you cannot sue a government agency and recover. Well, there are exceptions to that, and I think this case is going to fall into the exceptions. I also think that FINRA is going to be sued up and down and across because FINRA's membership is pretty much the entire brokerage industry of the United States, and that includes the large investment banks who have brokerage arms. Of course, many of those now have been scooped up by commercial banks, as occurred with Merrill Lynch. The point is that FINRA is a private membership organization. That private membership organization's regulators and its predecessor totally failed in their duty to protect the public, negligently, willfully failed, and there is a tremendous deep pocket and no even conceivable problems of the type that you may have when you sue the government, which is, as I say, normally immune but not always immune.
Larry,
so
I have to ask you this. My understanding is Mary Shapiro is the head of FINRA. So where does she stand on this? Will there be a suit against her?
It wouldn't surprise me if she is named as a defendant. I can't say that she will be. And knowing the courts, they would probably dismiss her as the defendant, but I'm not sure about that. I'm also not positive she will be named as a defendant, but I do think it likely that she'll be named a defendant, as well as FINRA being named a defendant, and how somebody and she was head of the NASD as well before FINRA, she was head of NASD at the time that the NASD was inspecting Madoff, according to a congressman, on a biannual basis. So here's somebody who, if that congressman is right, was head of FINRA was head of NASD when it gave when it whitewashed Madoff and didn't tell the people there were problems, was head of FINRA when it whitewashed Madoff and didn't tell people that there were problems, and now will be head of the SEC, which whitewashed Madoff and didn't tell people there were problems, and didn't tell them, even though it had put them off their guard by saying in 1992 that there were no problems.
Larry, we're out of time. We're out of time. The hour flies by. You're on the air a lot. You know how the time gets away from you. There's never enough time. I've only got time to thank you for coming on. This was a great discussion. This really was. And I thank you very, very kindly for coming on.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for having me, Steve.
Thank you, Larry. And we'll be back tomorrow with another program, another terrific guest, and important topics. Tune in.